Hello, everybody. This is Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate for president in 2020. And these Green Socialist podcasts are about continuing to advance the eco-socialist program. We talked about policies, organizing, what do we think about different issues. So let me say a few words about, you know, what's been happening this week before we take your questions and comments. First thing I want to do is acknowledge the passing of Frank Young, who, if we have an OG in the Green Party, an original Green, he certainly would be one of them. He was a co-founder of the Mountain Party, which is the Green Party affiliate in West Virginia. And he was a longtime leader for decades in recycling and in environmental movements in West Virginia, in the Ripley and Charleston area where he lived. And he was a national committee member who helped push through the eco-socialist plank in the National Green Party platform. So he's going to be missed. Probably the biggest news this week has been, it broke last Saturday when we talked, with this Omicron virus. And, you know, it grows out of this vaccine apartheid where Big Pharma will be sticking to their vaccine patents. And it was October of 2020, over a year ago, that India and South Africa proposed at the World Trade Organization that those patents be waived so we can get everybody vaccinated around the world. And it's mainly been the EU countries, you know, England and Germany in particular. Biden has taken the position first in the spring of 2020, and then just last week that the US supports lifting those waivers. But what they say in public and what they do at the actual meetings of the World Trade Organization are two different things. And there was an article in these Times that shows that. And I'm going to put that in the chat here in a second, if people want to look at that. So, you know, even when you think Biden might have been doing one thing right, that's for public consumption. In the background, is not so right. And then another thing that happened just yesterday is that the U.S. withdrew from negotiating the Iran, getting the Iran nuclear deal back in place. We have been conducting indirect negotiations because of conditions that Iran put up. Iran was saying, we don't want to negotiate till you lift all the sanctions. And the U.S. was saying, that's not serious. And so they were negotiating through third parties, but they withdrew yesterday. And it's not just the U.S. that's angry at Iran, which is not just, you know, making its demands about sanctions, but wants to rewrite a whole lot of the deal, substantial changes. So the EU, Russia, and China are frustrated as well. So this doesn't look good. And now there's renewed talk in Israel about a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. So it's a dangerous situation. And, you know, the U.S. says it will continue to deal with Iran diplomatically, but somehow those negotiations got to get back on track, because the last thing we need in the world is another nuclear power. So that's not a good situation. And here domestically, we still have no movement on the voting rights and election protection legislation that's stuck in the Senate. And we're getting no leadership from Biden on that. The reporting is they don't want to talk about it until they get Build Back Better passed, which at this point, if they get it done by Christmas, it'll be a Christmas gift. It doesn't look good. And meanwhile, the GOP is doing their partisan gerrymandering. At this point, they've done enough of it. They pretty much grab the House in the next election just by the way they've drawn the boundaries. And did I disappear? No, I'm still here. Somehow my computer played a game on me. Sorry about that. I thought I'd... There I am. Okay. So, so the lines are drawn to the point where, you know, I mentioned Texas. I'll mention it again. Latinos are 40% of the state. They only have a majority in 20% of the congressional seats. African Americans are 20% of the state population. They only have a majority, I think it's in 3 seats now. Asians are 5 or 6%. They got no seats. I mean, basically the Republicans are drawing the line, so they're going to gain a net gain of a number of seats. Same thing in states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. I'm missing one of the big ones. Anyway, they're just entrenching minority rule by the way they draw the lines. This federal legislation would have preempted that. Now, if it ever does get passed, they're going to have to take it to court, and that probably won't be in time for the midterm elections. And, you know, to me, this is just crazy. Biden is still pursuing bipartisanship with a party that tried to steal the election from him. You know, he did it with the infrastructure bill, which he's out now touting. And he did it when he reappointed this week, Jerome Powell renewed. He was appointed by Trump to be the Fed chair. Biden reappointed him. You know, the infrastructure bill is full of fossil fuel subsidies. It's rebuilding or, you know, renovating the car infrastructure when we need more public transportation. And, you know, Jerome Powell and the climate movement's been trying to get rid of him. You know, he refuses to use the Fed's regulatory powers over the banks to rein in their risky investments in fossil fuels. And actually, fossil fuel investments have gone up under his watch. So, you know, Biden's pursuit of bipartisanship with a party that, you know, tried to steal the election and continues to put forward the big lie that Trump won is just baffling to me. I mean, I don't agree with Biden. He's a neoliberal war hawk. But, you know, you think in the interest of just self-preservation, the Democrats would get this legislation passed so they'd at least have some power. But they're talking about still the reporting in Washington is Biden, the White House thinks they can overcome what the Republicans are doing just by mobilizing the Democratic vote. But those the way those lines are drawn in overwhelmingly Republican districts, you know, Democrats aren't going to be able to mobilize enough. So they're basically handing power back to the Republicans. And that's a disaster for the climate, for economic justice, any hope of police reform, you name it, let alone tax reform. What happened to repealing the Trump tax breaks? That was in Biden's original American Jobs Plan, which has been shrunk down to Build Back Better. It's not in there now. And of course, the Republicans aren't going to do it. So, you know, this is just a bad situation. So after that negative news, let me just report on a positive victory we won this week. The Jordan Cove Energy Project out there in Oregon and the pipeline they wanted to build, ending up with a liquefied natural gas export facility at Coos Bay in southwest Oregon. The company, it was based in Calgary, up in Alberta, Pembina, asked the federal regulators this week to withdraw their authorizations. They've given it up. And, you know, I feel really good about that. I went way out of my way when I was campaigning in Oregon from, you know, the Eugene-Portland axis, where most of the people are, to go out to Coos Bay on the coast to support the opposition to that negative fossil fuel infrastructure project. And just congratulations to the climate and environmental groups and the landowners, particularly the indigenous nations on whose land the pipeline would have traversed. That's a victory. And again, it shows, as I've been saying all year, we may not be getting a climate plan from the Biden administration, but we can win these fossil fuel infrastructure fights. We've won a number of them. You know, Keystone was, you know, probably the most prominent, but we stopped a project and a couple here in New York in the last month. There's some other pipelines and now this one. So we need to keep fighting, particularly, you know, about 20 or so gas and oil pipelines that the industry is still trying to build, a couple more liquid nitrified gas export facilities that the Biden administration is permitting. And I think, you know, probably maybe the top of the list right now are Enbridge's Lines 3 and 5. Enbridge is another Canadian corporation, and they are piping dirty Alberta tar sands oil across Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, through lines 3 and 5 on their way to refineries. And of course, that Alberta tar sands is, you know, what we call a climate bomb. So we got to keep fighting on these, but we won one this week. So let's take heart from that. And I'll stop there and look for your questions and answers and comments. Emil Sachs, Howie, with Trump ready to run again and further empower fascism, are you still prepared to advocate for a Green Party presidential run, even if it's a different candidate? Thanks. Absolutely. I mean, what we're learning from this year with the Democrats in power at the federal government is they don't have a clue about how to fight fascism. They can't get H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which has now been reintroduced as a watered down Freedom to Vote Act. They called it H.R. 1 and S1 for a reason. It was a top priority, and they can't get it passed. And Biden's still trying to do bipartisan work with these fascists. So, and then we know when the Democrats, they do the same thing. They're doing partisan gerrymandering here in New York, in Illinois, Maryland, Oregon. I mean, how can they criticize the Republicans when they're doing the same thing, where they have control of the state governments? And so they can't get voting rights and election protection bills passed. They're gerrymandering. And then in a lot of states, they're making it harder for the Green Party to get on the ballot. And party suppression is a form of voter suppression. It's what authoritarian governments do. So, you know, the Trumpies may be openly right-wing fascists, anti-democratic and authoritarian and racist. But like I mentioned with Biden, in his position on the vaccine waivers, you know, what the Democrats say and what they do are two different things. And so that has to do with the democracy, anti-authoritarian positions we have that the Democrats don't represent well on. And then we got the climate crisis. And then we got the nuclear arms race. And then we got the inequality crisis, where inequality kills, and we have lowering life expectancies in this country. I mean, all the issues we ran on in 2020 remain, and the Democrats haven't made them any better. So, of course, the Green Party should run. The problem is, as you indicate or imply, people are going to be afraid of Trump or whoever the Republicans put up who's a Trump wannabe, and people are going to feel like they got to vote for the Democrat just to stop that far-right extremism. That's understandable, but if all we can do is support neoliberal hawks to fight the fascists, we're not going to solve the problems we face, which for me comes back to we've got to prioritize changing the electoral system to proportional representation. Ranked choice voting is gaining more and more across the country, but mostly that's single member ranked choice voting, instant runoff voting. What we need is ranked choice voting for multi-member districts, which will create proportional representation, green representation, a multi-party system, which will change the whole dynamic. As it is right now, the left is isolated. On the right, it's interesting. I've been talking to the Libertarian gubernatorial candidate here in New York, Larry Sharp, who ran last time, is running again. And he's getting support from the Rockefeller Republicans, the Lincoln Project, the anti-Trump Republicans. So we're in a situation where on the right, because they don't really want to change the system, they want to make it work better, capitalism, but they don't want to be crazy like Trump. The libertarians are going to get a lot of support, money, and probably votes. Whereas on the left, the whole center left, you know, lines up to just vote for the Democrats to stop the Republicans. So we're in a difficult situation. And until we change how elections are conducted, so everybody gets their fair share of representation and power, we're kind of stuck on the left. And so that's why I've been advocating all year that, you know, the thing I got out of the 2020 campaign is we got to change the election system or we're really going to be marginalized because the Republicans are no longer a conservative party, they're an extremist party. So it's very difficult for us to get people to even vote for us. You know, as I say, if you don't vote for what you want, you're lost in the sauce. If you're for Medicare for All and a Green New Deal and student debt relief and you voted for Biden, nobody knew that because Biden was opposed to all those things. The only way you could express your support for those things was to vote for the green ticket. So we're going to have the same situation in 2024. It may even be more difficult than it was in 2020, given the dynamics of the Republican Party, which is still moving to the right. It's become more extremist than it was in 2020. So we have a difficult situation, but we just can't fold up our tents and leave the field, because then the whole dynamic is to the right. You know, the Democrats, the corporate Democrats will say, well, the Republicans are extremists, so we can take a more conservative corporate position and still get enough votes to win. Yeah, we absolutely got to run, whether it's me or somebody else. Scout Trooper 164, what are your thoughts on the tribalism that plagues the Republican Party? Yeah, they call it tribalism. I think at this point it's, well, you've got different segments. You've got a hardcore evangelical Christian right, which is for the Republican Party for their own culture warrior reasons. And that white Christian evangelicalism really goes back to when, after Brown v. Board of Education, to desegregate the schools, and they started setting up, you know, religious white academies to avoid desegregation. So you got that hardcore right, and that is a population that's aging out. They don't have as many young people as they do older people, but that's their hardcore. Then you've got another segment of particularly lower middle class people, what you might call the upper working class, and with good, relatively good jobs in manufacturing or trucking or something, or construction, you know, construction in particular, who tend to ally with that upper middle class. And by the conspiracy mentality of the Republicans, who blame the economic problems on scapegoats, immigrants, people of color, women, they're making those groups. The Republicans are making these white upper middle or lower middle class, upper working class people feel that that's what's threatening them, rather than the corporate assault on their living standards. I mean, just take trucking, for example. Before Carter deregulated the trucking industry, which was really, Carter started a lot of things that Reagan took further and Clinton took all the way. And one of them was deregulating. And back before deregulation, a trucker had job security, an income of about $120,000 a year in today's income. And what happened was, when they opened, they deregulated, then a lot of non-union trucking companies formed, outcompeted the unionized by lowering the labor costs. And so truckers today, you know, they nominally make maybe $40,000 or $50,000 a year, but all the hours they got to put in that are not on the clock means they're making sometimes less than minimum wage, federal minimum wage, $7.25 an hour. And that's what's happened. And it was not immigrants. It was not people of color. It was not women that did that to those truckers. It was corporate America and the neoliberal transformation of capitalism to deregulation, privatization, lower taxes on the rich, and that whole program. So, that's the base of the Republican Party right there. And then you got the country club Republicans that maybe don't feel like Trump. He's not somebody they'd invite to dinner, but they do like the tax cuts he gave them. So that's the Republican Party right there. So I just named, I think, sort of three tribes or social groups that are the base of the Republican Party. So that's my thoughts on who the Republican Party is. Of course, they're also, and these are people very important to the Republican Party, you know, billionaires, you know, Adelson, who's passed on, but his wife is still spending that money, the Mercers, some of these like them, you know, Wall Street, private equity and hedge fund, stupid rich people, and the Koch brothers. I mean, there's a whole class of billionaires and hundreds of millionaires that are back in the Republican Party for their own reasons, some of them ideological, some of them economic, because they don't want to pay taxes. And so that's your Republican Party. I think the left can appeal to particularly those lower middle class, upper working class people with an economic program that is makes sense, like the Green New Deal with a just transition. There was another study, this is news this week, that a company that basically does research on workers and recruiting found that a majority of fossil fuel workers would prefer to work in renewable energy. So there's a group that tend, a lot of them voted for Trump because he was for the pipelines and for the gas and oil drilling because that was their jobs. But they're open to a Green New Deal if their economic security is provided for by a just transition. So right there, there's a group we can target. And so anyway, I would say there are at least, well, four tribes, the billionaires, the evangelical, the white evangelicals, the people who felt economic hardship because of free trade and other things and are buying into the scapegoating, and then the country club Republicans that don't want to pay taxes. So that's a coalition that can be split with a good, positive, progressive populist or socialist program. Violated content boutique. Public transportation is less and less safe over time. So what good is expanding it? Who is going to use it? Well, there are two issues about safety. One is the infrastructure is eroding, so you can have accidents in public transportation. That can be fixed by investing in it. And there actually is some money in the infrastructure bill for that, some more money in Build Back Better. We need more money than both of them are proposing, but that's solvable. The other issue is, I think maybe you're referring to the crime, you know, and we've had some of it in the New York subways. And then, you know, it's just street crime. It's, you know, people either acting out violent impulses. There's some of that. And then there's just petty street robbery kind of stuff. And, you know, that's about fighting crime. It's not just public transportation. It's walking down the street. It's being in your home and somebody burglarizes it. That kind of crime, which actually isn't up. It's getting a lot of publicity. It's the shootings that are up and the homicides because of that. But most other crime is not up. Property crime, except for corporate crime, which is a whole other category, that is certainly up. And we can talk about that, particularly in the, you know, pharmaceutical industry and the opioid crisis and some other things. So, people, who's going to use public transportation? You know, I would argue that public transportation now should be free in the cities. We got to get people out of these cars and individualize the transportation system for reasons of energy and resource efficiency to deal with the climate crisis. So who's going to use it if it's free? Well, people that want to save some money, and a lot of people are struggling meeting their bills. And then we got to make it convenient and safe, which may require, you know, having police officers patrolling or officers that are with the transit authority. Of course, there you got problems with police brutality. We've seen that. Oscar Grant out at Oakland at Bay Area Rapid Transit is a glaring example. But, you know, we got to deal with the police, too. That's a whole nother thing. But anyway, I think make it free, make it convenient, and a lot of people are going to use it. Vicky Corden, what do you think of Florida having its own army? DeSantis has some ulterior motives. Yeah, he sure does. The kind of state-based National Guard, but its nation doesn't have anything to do with it. It'd only be regulated by the state. We got one of those in New York. And it really, you know, they basically get involved when there are, you know, natural disasters, public emergencies. And it's a way for a lot of people to feel like they're making a contribution. So we have that in New York. It really depends on who's leading it. And DeSantis, you're right, he does have ulterior motives. He's getting ready to run for president. This man is crazy. You know, he's got Florida with the third highest rate of COVID deaths, and he's trying to prevent, you know, schools and businesses from having mask mandates or vaccine mandates. And, you know, it seems like he'd rather have his people die than, you know, participate in public health measures. So, yeah, the idea of a state guard is not inherently wrong if it's, you know, there to be deployed, you know, in public emergencies. But DeSantis, I can only imagine he has repressive purposes in mind, like suppressing Black Lives Matter demonstrations and stuff like that. So it's like our military, you know, we don't want to blame the soldiers. We got to blame the civilian leadership that puts them into these wars. People get in the military for all kinds of reasons, economic. Some think it's the way to, you know, be of service and in there for good motives. And they're put in bad situations by the civilian leadership. So, you know, a state guard, you know, may be needed to augment the National Guard to deal with emergencies. Florida, you know, is in hurricanes way. So that would make sense. Miami's about to sink from rising sea level. So, you know, there's infrastructure they could work on. It could be like a civilian conservation corps. I mean, a lot of things you could do positive with it, but in DeSantis' hands, it's going to be a problem. Violated Content Boutique. Many Blacks are disappointed and disgusted with attention to their needs after being the ones who decide elections. Any suggestions? Yeah, we need a Black left that declares its political independence from the Democratic Party, that takes their support for granted. And we had probably the best, most articulate people for that were Bruce Dixon, who was the managing editor of Black Agenda Report, and his colleague Glenn Ford, who was the principal writer. And they were very clear on that. And unfortunately, Bruce, who's the guy that really got me over the hump to run in 2020, passed away during the campaign, and Glenn Ford passed away earlier this year. And I haven't seen people to step into their place and make the argument to the Black left as clearly as they did. And but that's, I think, you know, what needs to happen. Because otherwise, if there's not an option for Black people as voters, other than the Democratic Party, because they're sure enough not going to vote for the Republicans, who look to Black people like the Ku Klux Klan, and they're right. You know, they get taken for granted, because what else are they going to do until we build a strong left? And the Greens are trying to do that. And it's too bad that we don't have Bruce Dixon around to, you know, urge Black activists to do that. And so that's, you know, what I'm hoping to see is, you know, some Black writers and intellectuals, you know, make the case for independent Black political action. Because right now, the Democrats are taking them for granted. I mean, it's just so pathetic what has happened. You know, like the Congressional Black Caucus has been corporatized. And those of them who are in the Progressive Caucus are some of the ones that have been leading the compromises, like Clyburn down there in South Carolina, who is opposed to Medicare for All because he gets lots of money from the insurance industry. So that's what Glenn Ford called the Black misleadership class. And what we need is people coming up from the grassroots and calling for independent Black political action. And the Greens need to work with those folks. Jay Walker, Howie, how can we get the people in these stream comments to actively participate in their local or state Green Party and with caucuses like the National Youth Caucus? Well, I always urge people to get involved, build their Green locals. You can find links to the state parties on the National Green Party website. And then when you get to the state Green Party website, you can usually find the locals, although the states have various degrees of organization and clarity on their websites about how to do this. But I mean, if you really want to find the people in your state, you'll find them because there's some online presence. And then caucuses, yeah, if you're under 35, the youth caucus is a good place to get involved with other young Greens. And, you know, as I've been saying, I often end these calls with urging people to stay active and do so as part of an organization, particularly the Green Party. The old saying is there's no such thing as an unorganized socialist. And the other point I always make is you're going to be a lot smarter and more effective working in a group, because whatever you're thinking, you'll have people to bounce it off. And, you know, you put minds together, you come out with something better than what you might have just thought up by yourself. And that's particularly important in this age of social media, where people can sit at home and just be online and really not have the kind of give and take that happens when you're in a organization that is talking issues through and coming to conclusions. So, yeah, I mean, thanks for bringing that up. I think everybody's got to be involved, because it's going to take a mass movement. We got the thing we can bring. The people we're fighting are organized money. We got to have organized people to beat them. Julie Baumer, as a newbie here, can you lay out what the Green Party is for? Well, sure. The Green Party, you know, originally united in Germany around four pillars, we call them. And they're a good summary of where we stand to this day. One is grassroots democracy, which means not just elected people to represent us, but setting up institutions and processes whereby we can participate in the ongoing process of democracy, which is not the result of an election, but a process that includes a lot of discussion, coming to conclusions, and then voting on what we want. So grassroots democracy is one. Another is peace or nonviolence. We don't initiate violence to make social change. We will let people defend themselves. But peace in the world is a huge issue, particularly now with a new nuclear arms race. And, you know, we got to have somebody stand up for peace, because the two major parties keep voting the Pentagon more money than they asked for. So peace is the second one. Third one is social justice. You know, we stand against discrimination and for more economic equity with things like single payer health care and a job guarantee and a guaranteed income above poverty and tuition free public education programs like that. And then the fourth, of course, is ecology. I mean, we're the ones that are saying we can't live in a system that's based on endless growth, and we've got to produce enough so everybody gets their basic needs met, but do it within ecological limits. So that's, you know, generally what the Green Party is for. Now, I ran a campaign for an eco-socialist Green New Deal. And so what we were talking about was a massive public program to convert to 100% clean energy and zero greenhouse gas emissions in a decade to deal with the climate crisis. And that involves public ownership of the power production sector, the energy sector, the transportation sector, and a lot of manufacturing, so we can create the green machinery so we can produce things like cement and steel without greenhouse gas emissions. We stood for an economic bill of rights, so everybody has the right to a job, who's willing and able to work, an income above poverty through a guaranteed minimum income built into the tax structure. If your income's below the poverty line, government sends you a check every month to bring you up above it. Healthcare, universal healthcare through a, you know, public system. We support the single payer healthcare insurance proposals, but we want to go further and have a national health service like the UK does, where the hospitals and facilities are publicly owned and the doctors and nurses and so forth are public employees, and in our system be accountable to locally elected health boards. So we have some say over the system, unlike, for example, Medicare today, which I'm a part of. So healthcare, education, lifelong public education from childcare and pre-K through public colleges. And then a secure retirement. We need to increase the Social Security, which is the pension for seniors, So no seniors below poverty line. And then finally, I mentioned this new nuclear arms race and the militarism. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists has the doomsday clock they've kept since the atomic bomb was developed in the 1940s, the closest it's ever been to midnight, because the U.S., followed by Russia and China in response, are modernizing their nuclear forces. So they have hypersonic missiles that are much faster than the old ones. And in the case of Russia and the United States, a crazy military doctrine of what's it called? What they want to do is escalate to de-escalate. I guess that's what it's called. And that means in a conventional war, if you're losing, use some tactical nukes, escalate, and then you de-escalate. But that won't happen. Once the nukes start flying, they're all going to fly, and that'll be the end of us. So those are the things we tried to raise in the presidential race. And so I hope that, you know, gives you a good idea what the Green Party stands for. Julie Barmhart, you seem like a nice man, and I think it's great you're taking the time to do this and speak with the people about things. Just wanted to give you a thumbs up. Well, thank you. And I want to generalize on that. We all got to be doing that. I've talked about deep canvassing or relational organizing. We got to go out and talk to not just the people we can normally mobilize for green activities, but just regular people on the blocks, knock on their doors, talk to them, let them get to know you, listen to them, see what their concerns are, and listen more than you talk. People don't want to be preached at. They want to know somebody cares about them and is willing to listen. Because most people don't vote on the details of policy. They vote on who in their gut they feel really cares about them and will look after their concerns. And we need to do a lot more of that in order to build the Green Party as a mass party and not just a cadre of people who already have progressive politics. So I'm doing my little part here. I go out in the neighborhood and talk to people, and I think all of us need to do that and build our local Green Party chapters. So they're not just a small collective of activists, but a group that's got, you know, a broad base in the community. And then we can start winning elections and making changes at the municipal level and build our way up from there. Andrew Hager, as an independent centrist myself, I believe a centrist independent representative running for president would be a step in the right direction for our country's democracy. Your thoughts, Howie? Well, there's a lot of big money behind that proposition. Serve America movement is one of them. But I don't think there's more room in the center. The Democrats already got that spot. I actually ran against the first Serve America movement candidate when I ran for governor in 2018. She had been the mayor of this city here that I'm in, Syracuse. And I got more votes than her in the city, in this county, and in the state. Because, you know, what she was talking about really wasn't that different from what Andrew Cuomo was talking about. And the only reason I think she was running against Cuomo is she had been a state co-chair of the Democratic Party and made some criticisms of Cuomo, which are valid. I actually think she was right about that. But Cuomo, you know, was kind of a vindictive guy, and he got her removed from state co-chair, and she was in his doghouse. So this Serve America movement, you know, recruited her to run. So I don't know if there's that much room in the political spectrum, although I will say on the center right, with the Republicans becoming so extremist, there may be room. I mentioned this earlier, I believe, here, that, you know, I'm talking to a libertarian candidate in New York, and he's getting people who are, you know, the old moderate country club Republicans, Rockefeller Republicans, anti-Trump Republicans, Lincoln Project types, supporting him because it looks like we'll get a Trumpy representing the Republican Party here in New York. And so the Republican Party will split if that happens. And it'll be interesting to see how big it is. I think there's more room on that sort of center-right part of the spectrum than the center left, because the Democrats got that corporate liberalism. That's their policy. That's really their brand. I think where there's a vacuum is with working class people. The Democrats don't speak to working class people effectively, nor do the Republicans, although they're claiming they are. The Republicans, most working class people understand, Republicans stand for, you know, basically the business interests, who the working people experience daily as not their friends. Scout Trooper 164, Howie, what can Greens do to halt fear-mongering so Democrats don't keep winning against Republicans? Well, I think what you're saying is the fear-mongering is what motivates progressives to vote for the Democrats to stop the Republicans. And, you know, it doesn't take much mongering to have fear of the Republicans if you're progressive-minded, given what the Republicans have become. I mean, it's just insane. The climate denial, the COVID denial, the big lie about Trump winning 2020 election. You know, there's a lot to fear in that, because if they get power, they're basically going to change the rules to entrench their minority support, because that's what they are in society, into permanent power. And they've got a lot of the judiciary. They've targeted that. You know, and they've been ruthless about it. Look at what McConnell did in the Senate to block Merrick Garland, who was really a moderate corporate Democrat, so they could get a right winger in. And they said it was like in the early spring, Scalia died, and McConnell said, we can't appoint somebody in election year. And then Ruth Bader Ginsburg dies a couple years later, and it's like September, and McConnell rams through the next conservative. So, you know, there's a lot to fear from what the Republicans are doing. The problem is the Democrats don't have solutions to these problems we've been talking about. So what can the Greens do to halt the fear mongering? Offer a positive program and just, you know, patiently explain that the Democrats don't know how to fight these fascists. You know, damn, Biden wants to do bipartisanship with them. That's scary. So, you know, maybe we do a little fear-mongering about the Democrats' collaboration with the Republicans, not getting the voting rights and election protection bills passed, accommodating them on the Fed chair appointment this week, the bipartisan foreign policy, and so forth. So, and the other thing I'll say is, you know, when you get down to local elections, the fear is not such a big factor, and people are more willing to take risks for a progressive alternative. And that's where we got to build our political base. We should be electing thousands of people to city councils and school boards and county legislatures, and from there, the state legislatures, and from there to the House of Representatives. That's how we're going to get a foothold. And the other thing is to change the rules, get proportional ranked choice voting, so from multi-member districts, so we get proportional representation in our legislative bodies. Vicky Corden, I'm scared that after Roe is taken down, birth control, LGBTQ rights will be taken down or modified by the Supreme Court. What do you think? Yeah, I mean, here's another thing where the Democrats have a bill. I'm forgetting the name of it, but it basically codifies Roe versus Wade. It's been in the hopper for decades. And now they're sort of talking about it. It did pass the House, stuck in the Senate. And that would just take the power away from the Supreme Court on that. But they can't get it done because they won't go after the filibuster. And Biden is silent on that. And basically he's made Manchin president. And I guess sent him a vice president. And so, you know, we should be scared that these things are going to happen. And what do I think? We can't rely on the Democrats to fight for us. We got to fight independently for ourselves on these issues. On Roe, we can get state legislation passed to codify Roe. Not in every state, but we've done it in New York. We can do it in other states. Same with LGBTQ rights, you know, like marriage equality that passed in a lot of the states before Supreme Court kind of ratified it. Yeah, birth control. Yeah, reproductive rights. Again, that's something that should be part of a public health system. And we got to just keep fighting for those things. And, you know, maybe if Roe gets taken down by the Supreme Court, a lot of people will get mad and mobilized. Hopefully that can be sustained. And anything, what do I think? I think we got to keep fighting. Scout Trooper 164, why do you find Bernie Sanders as an old-fashioned liberal? Asking because I'm not really sure about how liberalism ran back in the past. Well, liberalism in this country was close to social democracy, which is basically socialists reforming capitalism so it functions better. That hasn't been a long-term solution, but we did have a period of welfare states in Western Europe and a New Deal compromise in this country. And that's what Bernie Sanders is trying to restore. Most of his reforms are basically New Deal type reforms. So, you know, national health insurance, so Medicare for all. Most industrial countries have some form of that. And so that's not a socialist transformation. That's taking the healthcare sector and saying this should be a public service, not a buy or die commodity. Putting more money into education, investment in infrastructure, tuition-free public college. A lot of these things we already have in, you know, the rich industrial countries in Western Europe. So that's what I mean by Bernie being an old-fashioned liberal. Now, the old socialist is still back there. I knew him when he, you know, he did a film on Eugene Debs and he was running as an independent against the Democrats. And, you know, that's still in the back of his mind. If you looked in detail at his website and programs, like the his version of the Green New Deal would have reduced carbon emissions to zero by 2030, largely through the public sector. He wanted to use the federal their Energy Marketing Administration, I think it's called, to basically build the renewable generation and high voltage distribution to get, you know, large solar farms and wind farms to get that power to where it's needed. Those are in rural areas to urban areas. And then, for example, the agricultural program in his Green New Deal talked about having the public buy up farmland that farmers couldn't afford to maintain ownership of because of you know, rising rents and land values. So he was willing to use the traditional socialist remedy for a lot of these problems of social ownership and democratic control. So Bernie functions as an old-fashioned liberal. And I think, you know, in the back of his mind and his, you know, his personal wishes, he's more of a socialist, but he doesn't practice that in his public policy. Which in a way is understandable because there are not many socialists in the Congress. You know, they really understand socialism. And, you know, I'm thinking right now, Bernie may be the only one. I know there's some DSA members, but some of them are just recently joined and they haven't been around the socialist movement that I've been aware of in, you know, the last couple of decades. How do you get Texas to join its electric grid to the rest of the country? I wonder if that guy Beto O'Rourke stands for that. I know he's taken on Governor Abbott, who is, you know, one of the dumbest Republican governors around. I mean, him and DeSantis are in a contest for that. Well, there's some other contestants as well. But, you know, that made them vulnerable to that polar vortex that came down and froze Texas. And, you know, people, some people lost their lives. A lot of people had frozen pipes, food spoilage with the grid out. So how do you get Texas to join it? You got to get somebody with common sense, not just in the governorship, but the damn legislature in Texas is, you know, it may be the most right wing in the whole country. So, you know, they would have to sign on to that as well. The grid there in Texas is regulated by the state, I believe. So you got to change the politics of Texas. And that's, I think that's coming. You know, the demographics are going that way. It's just, damn, Democrats are letting the Republicans gerrymander their entrenchment in power, even though they're becoming a minority. That's the way it's headed in Texas. And so that's another thing you got to deal with, the election rules. Violated Content Boutique. Howie, this tends toward privatization of public services. This trend toward privatization of public services is terrifying to me. I think this may be part of the neoliberal agenda. What do you think about this? Yeah, it absolutely is. It's one of the pillars of the neoliberal version of capitalism. The argument they make is that by paying private companies to do these public services, they're going to be more efficient because of competition in the market and all this stuff. But the fact is, their public services, a lot of them are natural monopolies. There is no competition. There is no market. What you've done is hired a private company to do what you did before through the public sector. And that private company has got to pay shareholders dividends. Its top executives want to make stupid money with exorbitantly high salaries, whereas public service management or public sector management has more reasonable salaries. So it ends up costing more. And because for every dollar that's put into those public services that are not spent on services, but are retained by the company, that makes the company wealthier. So that's the incentive structure in the privatization of public services. Yeah, this is part of the neoliberal agenda. The privatization of schools was a big part of it. That's a $600 billion a year cash flow, revenue flow that these private companies want a part of. That's what the charter school movement is about. That's what the voucher movement is about. And we know, we've had a lot of experience now, a couple decades, these charter schools, a lot of them turn out to be corrupt, fraudulent, money-making schemes. And even those that, you know, try to provide an education, they don't do it any better on average than the public schools. So what we should be doing is putting that money into the public school system to make it better. Instead of, you know, when you give money to charters, the public school system still has the same overhead costs in terms of its buildings, the school buses it's got to pay for, and all these other things. And then you're just taking money away from that and giving it to the charter schools, sometimes letting them take over publicly paid for buildings or co-locating a private school and a public school, a charter school and a public school in the same building. The experience in New York under Bloomberg was the charter schools got the best half of the building. They got priority. And so, you know, this is, you know, just the wrong way to do public services. You know, the military, a lot of things we used to do in-house for, you know, lower cost are now contracted out to companies like Halliburton, Dick Cheney's old company. And, you know, they screw things up. They're not as regulated or under the, you know, direct control of the military. So we had that terrible example where one of those contractors got the plumbing and the electrical wiring screwed up. So soldiers would go in and take a shower and get electrocuted. that's what happens when you farm out what you can do in-house at less cost. Lee Showron. How can we get people to stop talking about election fraud and move on and worry about the next election? Because I'm sick and tired of hearing about the 2020 election. I don't know if we can stop the Republicans. That seems to be their big talking point. They want to say the system is fraudulent, that Trump won the election, and they don't have any evidence. They've, you know, put up over 60 lawsuits that the judges, including Trump appointees, have thrown out, you know, as frivolous and irresponsible. And I'm afraid we're just going to keep hearing about it, because that's part of the Republican playbook right now. Unfortunately, you know, the Democrats, this For the People Act, I mean, we have our criticisms of it, which is still in the Freedom to Vote Act about the public campaign finance section. But on the whole, there are a lot of good measures there. And like I said at the top, the failure of the Democrats to get that through, because they won't take on Manchin and Sinema and Feinstein and these other Democratic senators who want to keep the filibuster. That's why we're talking about election fraud. And the real election fraud we're going to face is in a lot of these states, the Republicans have set it up so Secretary of State or the legislature they control can basically overrule the vote and put their own people in office who didn't win the election. I mean, that's where we're headed. And I think part of the fight back against the Republicans' big lie is going to be talking about the election fraud they're getting ready to perpetrate, and about how the Democrats have not been effective in fighting that. Vinci B, can we not navigate the political sphere without paying lip service toward establishment talking points? Or should we redefine economics for all? Well, I think, you know, establishment talking points have to be criticized when they're not right. Most of them are not right. And should we redefine economics for all? Well, I think what we really need to talk about is economic democracy or socialism, so that the economy is under the control of the people and not at the mercy of blind market forces and the influence of concentrated wealth in those markets and in the regulation of those markets by government, which regulate them in the favor of the concentrated wealth. So a precondition of political democracy so that we can regulate markets is economic democracy, where we have firms and public enterprises that are controlled by the people that participate in them, and where regulation is in the public interest because you don't have concentrated private interests capturing the regulators. So, and, you know, establishment talking points, I mean, there's so many. I mean, right now in the inflation debate, I think the reason we got high prices is there's a supply constraint coming out of the pandemic. And we've had a deregulated markets, like I mentioned in trucking, where companies have just-in-time delivery of raw materials or finished products that they need. And you start getting delays in the supply chains, and then you don't have the materials you need for production. So that's a case where, you know, regulation and a little more raw materials and intermediate products on hand would be better than just in time, where they don't really store anything. They just expect it to be delivered just before they need it. And that doesn't work well when the supply chain is disrupted. That's what we're facing in terms of inflation. There's also the energy price, the oil price, which the Saudis and OPEC were trying to keep high for their own reasons, although that's now being undermined. The oil price of oil is coming back down because demand has come back down. And then the other thing, talking point, is and this is coming more from the right, but you know, from the Manchin types as well, they're worried about wage price spirals, where the wages go up, so the cost of goods are raised to cover the wages, and you get in a wage price spiral. I don't think that's what's going on right now, because the wage increases are actually less than inflation was on an annual basis last month. And that doesn't seem to be the dynamic. I think it's more the supply chains. But an establishment talking point is wage price spirals. We got to be able to deflate that. Another establishment talking point is having a higher minimum wage costs jobs. And we have a lot of research to prove that's not true. And now we have the three most recent Nobel laureates in economics. Their research was on how that's not true internationally when they looked at minimum wage standards around the world. So that's a talking point that we got to debunk. And there are a lot of them. So I think we go into the political sphere, and if whatever the issue is, if the establishment talking points are wrong, we got to be armed with the data and the arguments to say you're wrong. And that's an hour. So I thank everybody for being here today. I think I'll close with what was brought up about, you know, getting people involved in the Green Party and the youth Greens. And that is, we've all got to be involved in organizations to be effective. You just can't do it online in your little silo. So I urge people, if they're not now involved, to get involved with an organization in their community, preferably a Green Party, if there isn't one, and you don't feel you're capable of, you know, organizing it yourself or getting it started, get involved in some kind of group and get the experience so you can help build the Green Party down the road. That's what we got to do, because, you know, some of the issues we went over today, you know, the Republicans are crazy, but the Democrats are not an alternative, and they don't even know how to fight the extremism from the Republican side. So that's why we need an alternative politics, and we went over a lot of the issues we should be pushing, and we need to be organized to do that. So, and we had that victory on the Jordan Cove project out there in Oregon. So I know a lot of people are kind of depressed about what's been going on in Congress at the federal level, the climate issue, but we can win these issues. And, you know, victories build upon themselves. And there are a lot of people that are with us. They're a bit demoralized, but if we're out there, you know, showing good spirit and being consistent, that will encourage other people to come with us. So, you know, we're in a difficult situation, but hope is not lost. And we got to be active on the issues to give people hope. So have a good week, and we'll see you next week.